Good afternoon and welcome to CSIS. I'm Steve Morrison, Director of the Africa Program here at CSIS, and we're thrilled today to be able to host Hillary Benn, head of DFID, Minister of State. You're all familiar with many of his achievements. He's here to talk to us about battling extreme poverty. It was about a year ago that we had the opportunity to host the Blair Commission, which we did up on the Hill in the lead-up to Glen Eagles. And we were very honored to do that, and we remained very active in the lead-up to Glen Eagles and a number of activities in London. And we're honored that we're able to come back together here today with Hillary, who was one of the lead architects and drivers of the many accomplishments associated with Glen Eagles and what happened afterwards. The commitments that were made, particularly with respect to Africa, were historic, and the commitment that's been made by Hillary and those at DFID to maintain a focus afterwards on the implementation and the satisfaction and compliance of those commitments has been unprecedented, really, the level of effort, and has been applauded and watched very carefully here. We've also been very interested in the work that you've done, Hillary, on climate change, on proposals and new thinking in your white paper process on reforming international institutions, on global health. These are all areas where you have taken a lead intellectually and politically in pushing the agenda, and I hope we'll have a chance to hear from you today more about all of those subjects. Hillary's agreed to present remarks in his prepared speech and then open the floor for questions and comments that can continue afterwards. So welcome. Thrilled to have you here. The floor is yours.
Well, Steve, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation to join you here today. I'm very pleased to be at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. Can I say the research that you undertake is of the highest quality? You constantly make us think, and I would encourage you to keep it up. I want today to reflect not only on the challenges that both of our countries face in fighting poverty on this very small and fragile planet of ours, but also on the way in which we do it and how it is seen by others. One of the things that I have learned in this job is that you don't have to spend very long talking about development, or come to think of it, foreign policy, climate change, trade, security, or just about anything else, without the conversation turning to the United States of America. A sign, of course, of the preeminence of your country, the most powerful in the world, the largest economy, which invites expectation and excoriation in equal measure. Now, I realise this may be sensitive territory for a visitor to enter, so can I begin by just setting out my modest credentials and my reasons for wanting to do so? I am half American. My mother was from Ohio. She came from Cincinnati. Ohio, as you know, is the mother of presidents, and that's certainly true for Republicans, because none has ever entered the White House without winning the state. Cincinnati, of course, is home to that great baseball team, the Cincinnati Reds, who I notice are 1.5 games back of the Cardinals in what is always a tough-fought Central Division. A name, incidentally, Cincinnati Reds, the great gave comfort to us as we were children growing up, because it reflected both Mum's hometown and the colour of the family's politics, on the British side of the family at least. Her ancestors came from France, they were Huguenots, and from Ireland. One fleeing religious persecution, the other seeking a better life, like so many people who have crossed the Atlantic over the centuries, and like many millions of people in the developing world today. And in 1812, the family, 14 of them, set off in two covered wagons from the East Coast. And 6 weeks later, they reached Butler County in Ohio, where they built their homestead. And 7 generations later, I was born to a Cincinnatian in West London, and that's the reason I'm standing before you here today. Now, that heritage, our interdependence, has led me to reflect on the half of what I am, where I come from, and how the country that makes up the other half sees the United States. Now, we, of course, have a great deal in common. That wonderful guide, which, if you've never seen it, I recommend you read it, produced for GIs coming to Britain during World War II, reminded them that our common speech, our common law, and our ideals of religious freedom were all bought from Britain when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. Mind you, as you will also know, George Bernard Shaw had other ideas when he talked of two nations divided by a common language, but there is no doubting the common bond between us. But more than anything else, because of your influence and position, what America says and what America does really matters. And I know just how proud you are of your traditions, your passion for liberty and freedom, and of your open society. So it's always very difficult for us when we come to discover that others do not all see us in the way in which we see ourselves. That was one of the questions that America had to ask itself in the wake of the unspeakable atrocity of 9/11. In talking about it with my American relatives, I shared their shock at what had happened and their fear for the future. We felt exactly the same in Britain after the 7th of July last year. As much because the bombers came from Britain, and three of them came from my constituency, my district that I represent in Leeds. And we know that there are parts of the world where there is resentment against both of our countries, and indeed against the West in general, from people, some of whom invest great hope in our power to change things, and yet measure that power against their own powerlessness. And it is something that we have to face up to as we remain resolute in defence of the common values that we hold dear. Now, our growing interdependence as a world means that we are increasingly affected by what happens in other countries, including conflict, terrorism, and religious extremism. We're all concerned to ensure our security, but we cannot cut ourselves off. We have global responsibilities, but we also have a duty to use our influence responsibly and with understanding of how others see us. And it is not an easy task. Now, this global interdependence and the link between security and development is one of the reasons, in my view, why fighting global poverty has moved from the margins of politics 50 years ago to its heart today. I talked about this earlier this morning with Bob Zelik, and he and I worked together on the Abuja peace agreement for Darfur, and perhaps we could talk about that later. I also met with Ambassador Tobias, who I know well from his days leading the US fight against AIDS, and with Ambassador Danilovich, who's done some very quick and impressive work with the Millennium Challenge account. Excuse me. And I'm greatly struck as I listen to the debate about foreign assistance here in the United States and see the structural changes that President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have made by how similar is our analysis about the challenge that we face in fighting extreme poverty, even if our approach sometimes differs. We both believe that peace and security are the foundations of progress, that good governance and fighting corruption matter, that creating the right climate for economic growth, including by agreeing a fairer world trade deal, is the best way in the long term to raise the finance needed to defeat poverty, that aid works to help build capacity, that debt relief lifts countries from that awful choice between paying the debt or paying the doctors and the nurses that will save people's lives, that providing education, clean water, healthcare for all the world's children, defeating AIDS is the great moral and practical challenge of our generation, and that when crisis strikes, be it drought or flood or earthquake, we all have a duty to help. President Bush said recently, "Fighting global poverty reflects this country's values. We know that when a neighbour needs assistance, that we have an obligation to help provide it." He's right. The truth is this. Here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. We know that in the developing world, pregnancy and childbirth claims the life of a woman every minute. Women who die mostly alone, unaided, on the darkened floor of a hut with no midwife or doctor to assist them. We know that today, as yesterday, and as will happen tomorrow, 6,000 children in the developing world will die. Do you know why? Because they don't have any of this. They drink contaminated water, they get diarrheal diseases, and their lives are extinguished. We know that each year, every year, malaria kills 1 million people, TB, 2 million people, AIDS, 3 million people. Everyone, a human life gone, potential unrealized. And because we see all of these things, I don't think we can claim anymore that we didn't know what was going on, because we do. And we therefore, as a world, have a very simple choice. Either we say, well, I'm very sorry about the condition of humankind, but I don't think we can do anything about it, and I'm going home, and I'm going to close the curtains and shut the door and wish the rest of the world would go away. Or we can ask the question, can we do something about this? Well, I think we can. It is, after all, the story of the country that I was born in. Go back 200 years to a time of enormous change in British society. The movement from the land to the towns and the cities is the Industrial Revolution, that bringing together of water and fire to create a technology that absolutely transformed this world of ours. The social reformers who helped to change things at that time, the pioneers of local government who built the clean water supply and the sewers that did more than anything else in the 19th century to prolong life expectancy in Britain, the dreamers of that age who dared to believe that one day every child in Britain would be able to go to school. Now, it was exactly the same process here in the United States. The founding fathers who created checks and balances in the federal system that made local government the building block of a great nation, because power should always lie with the people. America's great social reformers, from Harriet Tubman, helping to bring slaves north to freedom through the Underground Railway, which passed through my mother's hometown. Susan B. Anthony, found guilty of illegally voting for a Republican presidential candidate who led the women's suffrage movement, and Rosa Parks, who refused to be treated as a second-class citizen. Now, that's how both of our countries changed. And the truth is, we are now going through exactly the same process, but on a global scale. And we have made progress. In the past 40 years, life expectancy in the developing world has increased by a quarter. In the last 30 years, illiteracy has fallen by half. In the last 20 years, 400 million human beings have been lifted out of absolute poverty. We've beaten smallpox. We're that close to eradicating polio from the face of the earth. And yet, we have so much still to do. And that task is about to get even more difficult because of three big challenges. The first is climate change and depletion of natural resources. Now, climate change, least caused by the countries that will be worst affected by it. Secondly, the increase in the world's population, forecast to rise by about 50% in the next two generations. And thirdly, mirroring what happened in our countries 200 years ago, a movement from rural areas to towns and cities, first in Asia and then in Africa. By the time we get to 2050, a majority of people are going to be living in towns and cities. We are about to see the urbanisation of the developing world. Now, how are we going to do something about this? Well, the answer is by politics. In our countries, and politics in developing countries. That's what the One campaign here in the United States, the Make Poverty History campaign in Britain, are all about. The global equivalents of the social reformers of the 19th century in our two countries. And we made a start on our contribution a year ago at Gleneagles, where we agreed $50 billion a year in extra aid by 2010, with half of it to go to Africa. And it's worth making the point, if anyone doubts it, that aid works. It's helped double the number of children in school in Mozambique. It's helped abolish health fees and doubled clinic attendance in Uganda. Within 5 years, it's got another 7.5 million people access to safe water and sanitation in Bangladesh. And since 2003, it's helped to support an eightfold increase in the number of people on AIDS treatment in sub-Saharan Africa. At Gleneagles, we also agreed on debt cancellation worth $50 billion. It's in the process of happening now for 20 countries. It's helped Zambia, for example, to provide free healthcare in rural areas for the first time, and is helping Tanzania to build over 30,000 new classrooms. At the UN Millennium Summit, all nations agreed that states have a responsibility to protect their citizens from genocide, and where they fail to do so, the international community must act. We also agreed on a new Human Rights Commission and a peace-building commission. In March, we set up a new humanitarian fund for the United Nations to speed up our response when disasters strike. And just over 3 weeks ago in New York, we agreed a plan to try and get AIDS treatment to all the people who need it in the developing world by 2010. Now, we have worked together, all of us, the world community, to agree these things because we know that without a just world, we will not have a stable world. And the task now is to turn these commitments into practical help. So what do we need to do? Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that for development to happen, there has to be peace and security. 3 weeks ago, I was in Lashkargah in southern Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan, a country in which one in four children never live to celebrate their fifth birthday because they die of disease, where life expectancy is currently 44 years of age. You know, that's exactly the same as life expectancy in Britain 100 years ago. A country where, as the Director of Education described to me, intimidation by the Taliban in Helmand province has closed 60 of their 224 schools. The teachers have been threatened. In some cases, they have been murdered. In one case, a head teacher was taken out in front of his family and had his head cut off. Do you know why he had his head cut off? Because he insists on continuing to teach children, and the greatest crime of all is to continue to insist on teaching girls. 6 weeks ago, I was in Somalia at a refugee camp at a place called Wajid, home to 11,000 people who've been living there for 6 or 7 months, who fled the countryside when the drought killed their animals and shriveled their crops. A sign of the world to come, perhaps, if we don't deal with climate change. Yet in this camp, I saw rows of children in three tents provided by UNICEF, as many girls as boys, keen and as enthusiastic as any children I've ever met in any school I've ever been into, enjoying for the very first time in their lives the chance to go to school. Something good coming out of something terrible. Now, it's places and experiences like these that have taught me, taught all of us, both why development, people being able by their own efforts to change their lives for the better, is so important, and why unless we tackle poverty, injustice and inequality, we will never have a safe and secure world in which to live, regardless of where it is we happen to call home. We've learnt that preventing conflict is better than picking up the pieces afterwards. As we know to our cost, look at Darfur. We know that post-conflict countries have a 50% chance of starting fighting again within 5 years, so we need to work with them for more than just the short term. We know we need to build long-term stability as a foundation for future prosperity. We know that this involves providing basic services like education and health, creating a sense of hope and of good government, including through building institutions. And we know that if we ignore countries, failed states like Liberia, Somalia, Afghanistan, they can become safe havens for terrorism. We've got to work together better, and I hope that the Peace Building Commission will help us to do that. And we have to ensure that our agreement on responsibility to protect turns into a willingness to act. We have to do more to reduce the proliferation of small arms and light weapons. We need an international arms trade treaty. We must help continents like Africa to build their own peacekeeping capacity. And for all of these things to be done, we're going to need a more effective United Nations. Now, the second challenge is to invest in helping developing countries to build their own capacity. Because, as I hope I've demonstrated, our aid can help poor people to go to school and stay healthy, both of which are vital to their economic development. But our support needs to be long-term and predictable if governments are to be able to invest in their people for the long term. Let's take education. The United States, like Britain, like all of the countries of the world, believes that education is the best investment a society can make. And I welcome Laura Bush's leadership on this issue, because we know that going to school saves lives. A woman who's had the chance to go to school is 50% more likely to have her own children immunised. Being in school helps us to fight AIDS. In Swaziland, two-thirds of girls in school are free of the HIV virus. It's the opposite for girls out of school. Education makes the economy grow. An extra year of education for a girl can raise her future income by 10 to 20%. We know this, so let's get on with it. And some countries are, with our help. The abolition of primary school fees in Kenya helped an additional 1.5 million children into a classroom. In Zambia, it helped to increase girls' enrollment from 2/3 to over 80% in just 2 years. Burundi is the latest country to abolish primary school fees. 300,000 additional children turned up on the first day of term to say, "I've come for my school place." They need help now to employ more teachers and build more classrooms and buy more school books for those children. Political will, backed by aid, is making a difference, and the UK has just committed to spend $15 billion over the next 10 years supporting long-term education plans in poor countries. We expect at least 22 countries to have prepared plans by the autumn of this year, and they will be asking donors for help in funding them. And I think this is an issue on which the United States could lead the world, and it's a perfect opportunity for the Millennium Challenge account to provide major long-term funding. You could turn your No Child Left Behind campaign here in the United States of America into a global campaign on behalf of the world's poorest children. Thirdly, we need to work in ways that help to build this capacity. It is a lack of capacity that is the biggest cause of death and the absence of school places. And how much help we give and how we give it really do matter. Now, with great power, I believe, comes great responsibility, and with great wealth should come great generosity. These are certainly British values, seen most clearly when disaster strikes. They are American values too. The most prominent private expression of them has been the work of Bill and Melinda Gates, and most recently of Warren Buffett, who's giving away most of his fortune. Now, acts no different in kind, but only in scale, from those of millions of Americans who give so generously to those in need. It was de Tocqueville, after all, who nearly 200 years ago identified this characteristic. He said, "When an American needs the assistance of his fellows, it's very rare that it be refused." And as governments, we need to do the same. And we are. Over the past decade, UK aid has more than trebled. Under this administration, American aid has more than doubled, and in new ways too, with PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge account. And it is taxpayers' dollars, as well as taxpayers' pounds, that are paying to drop the debt and bringing new money for health and education. But is it enough? I don't think so. And in the UK, we're committed to achieving the long-held global target of allocating 0.7% of our national wealth in aid by 2013. Europe is committed to do this by 2015, which will generate an extra $100 billion a year. If the United States did the same, it would be another $100 billion a year. Think what a difference that would make. The other issue is how we work. And let me just take two examples. The way we give our aid and the fight against HIV and AIDS. In the UK now, we ask three questions of our development partners. Are you serious about reducing poverty? Do you uphold human rights and international obligations? Do you promote transparency, reform public financial management? Do you support good governance? Do you make sure the money goes where it was intended? And based on the answers that we get, we give our aid in different ways. In Zimbabwe, we don't give any aid to the government, but we provide food. We run an AIDS program. In Tanzania, on the other hand, we give a lot of our aid in the form of support to the government's budget, to the Treasury, to enable them to get on and do the things that they want. Now, I know the arguments about budget support, and we have some of them too in the UK, and the worry on the part of some that it's hard to track where the dollars and the pounds went. But the fact that the USA does not do budget support is one of the differences in our approaches, and it does separate you from other donors. And what I would simply say is that in the right circumstances, it's a very useful tool, as the recent independent evaluation carried out for the United Kingdom by the OECD shows, because one of its benefits is that it helps to build the very capacity and improved financial management that is at the heart of the policy that you are pursuing. And if our shared goal of accountable government is to be realised, so that people in developing countries look to their own governments to sort out their problems and not us, then we need to help build the capacity to do exactly that. And that's why I welcome very much what Ambassador Tobias had to say in his recent speech to the Advisory Committee on Voluntary Foreign Aid, when he spoke about the parallel systems of service delivery that have, in his words, allowed governments to shirk their responsibility. Citizens must understand, he said, that their governments are responsible, that they must make demands of their governments and reject excuses for failure. Now, fighting AIDS is also an issue of capacity, and it's one where the US has shown great leadership. We are the two biggest donors in the global fight against AIDS. You, like us, were one of the founders of the Three Ones, vital to make sure that the way we offer help actually assists those who are fighting the disease on the ground. Like us, you are a big supporter of the Global Fund, which has helped to raise more money. You also recognise, like us, that we need to do more to help countries to build their healthcare. If we're going to beat AIDS, what's needed is more doctors, more nurses, more drugs, more clinics, more hospitals. It's that lack of capacity which is the biggest obstacle. But there are some other issues. Abstinence is one, condoms is another, where we have a different approach. Now, I agree that there is good evidence that fewer sexual partners and delaying starting sex help to reduce AIDS. But the truth is that not everyone can or is able to abstain from sex. The truth is that some women sell sex for money and for food, that some people do inject themselves with drugs, and some men have sex with other men. Now, I know that these are difficult and embarrassing issues for some people and some societies, but human beings shouldn't die because they have sex. Embarrassment is temporary, death is permanent, and therefore I think we need to be open and honest. We need to fight stigma. We need to give people the knowledge and the means to protect themselves if we're going to win this fight. The fourth thing we have to remember is that progress in developing countries is going to depend above all on good governance. Good governance is about the capacity of governments to ensure security, to be able to get things done, to give people the chance to be heard and to respond to what they want. It's about creating a climate in which people from the country, from abroad, will want to come and invest their money. It's about ensuring the rule of law and effective policing. It's also about fighting corruption. Now, we, like you, care about this. We use proper safeguards and a rigorous system of audit and inspection. And when we see a problem, we take tough action to prevent any repetition and send a clear message that corruption will not be tolerated. Those guilty of criminal offences should be prosecuted and punished. But where problems arise, some people argue that we should suspend our aid. Now, I don't agree. Why should a child be denied education or a mother health care or an HIV-positive person AIDS treatment just because some in their government are corrupt? If all poor people lived in well-governed countries, fighting corruption would be a lot easier. But they don't. Poor people live in countries affected by conflict, in countries with few resources and poorly paid public sector workers, and where governments and institutions are often weakest. And I think that walking away from our responsibilities to poor people isn't the right thing to do. If necessary, we will change the way in which we give our aid, but if we're going to help weak and fragile states transform themselves into well-governed states, then we need to work with them and not around them. Now, because corruption is the result of a failure of governance, the best check on corruption is to strengthen the governance with which to fight it. And that means encouraging demand for good governance by supporting civil society, the media, parliaments, trade unions, communities, so that people's voices are heard and governments are held to account. Because in the end, it is politics that provides the means by which those who govern and those who give their consent to be governed reach decisions on what is to be done. Fifth thing we have to bear in mind is that economic growth is the best way to reduce poverty. It's how we did it in our countries. It's the best way to end the dependency of poor people on aid. Poor people are, of course, the private sector. They are the farmers, the entrepreneurs, the shopkeepers. They're also the people we're trying to help. And we know that a decent job is their single best chance of escaping poverty. The US, through the MCA, is using its funding to help countries trade more and to invest in the infrastructure necessary to do that. That's aid helping to increase growth. It's a UK priority too. But it's very hard to trade when the rules are unfair. And that's why Doha is so important. Why I'm pleased that President Bush has said that the US is ready to eliminate all tariffs and subsidies to trade. I share his view that the time has come for all of the world's richest countries, including those in Europe, to make these tough decisions. In his words, now is the time for the world to come together, not only for the benefit of our own economies, but as an important part of the strategy to reduce poverty around the world. What better way to start that process than ending the tariffs on the goods we import from the world's poorest countries? The WTO has got to agree a credible timetable for moving from 97% access for those poorest countries to 100% market access. I find it very hard to see how we can justify putting up barriers to the world's poorest countries. In the US, dairy products receive a tariff of almost 300%. In the EU, rice is covered by 39 separate tariff lines. And we have to move on cotton. $2 billion a year in the United States and almost $1 billion a year in the European Union in subsidies are making life really hard for almost 12 million poor people in West Africa. Is that fair? And finally, on this list of things to do, we have got to act to stop climate change. Because I think that climate change, the way we deal with it, depletion of natural resources, the way we respond, will be the ultimate test of global good governance. Sea level rise, too much or too little rain, and you know all about that in Washington after the last week, more frequent storms will lead, over time, to mass migration. If sea levels rise in the next 100 years, as some scientists predict, 1 in 10 of the population of Bangladesh is going to have to move house because they're not going to stay there and drown. Where are they going to live? There will be migration. We will see fragile economies undermined, water and food shortages, and potentially wars and conflict over water and natural resources. Agreeing a stabilization target, what rise in temperature the Earth can cope with, and then dividing up the available CO2 emissions, will be the greatest challenge of all. And we know that the developing world's need for energy is increasing, and we will have to help them to invest in cleaner forms of energy supply, including through the World Bank's energy investment framework, as well as supporting them on adaptation and mitigation. So there we have it. This, in my view, is what we need to do. The task is enormous, but I think we know in our hearts that it must be done, because defeating poverty is the moral and practical challenge of our generation, and one which our two countries, for reasons of a shared history and shared values, should and must rise to. Just think what we could achieve if we acted together in increasing aid, carrying on writing off debt, making trade fair, helping people in developing countries to deal with conflict, fight corruption, demand good governance, and earn their way out of poverty. That really would be an historic alliance across the ocean that so many have crossed in search of freedom and a better life. Like my forebears and yours, they carried with them a burning hope that they could change things for the better. And that same hope should inspire us in this generation to accept the responsibility that has fallen to us as together we seek to honour their memory and to play our part in building that better world and passing it on to those who will come after us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Earlier this week, when Warren Buffett made this historic decision to dedicate his fortune to most of his fortune to the Gates Foundation, they gathered in New York. They gathered at the New York Public Library. They were there deliberately because of the con- the link back to the 19th century and to the Carnegies and the Rockefellers. Mm-hmm. And David Rockefeller was in the room. This is a library founded by the Carnegies. When Warren Buffett spoke, it was with reference to global poverty and conditions and trying to act in a historical lineage. And it was quite remarkable that both the Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, and Warren Buffett were even thinking in these terms, and that they were crafting this moment around that that history. And it gets to one question that I wanted to put to you, which is, how do you begin to explain this moment that we're in, where there seems to be, from different directions, like this with Warren Buffett, a consciousness of development and poverty that is quite surprising when you think back just a few years? What is it that has contributed to this, to the formation of this moment? The other thing I'd like you to open with is a little bit more on China. Because you could argue that China is the single most effective force in lifting people out of extreme poverty. It's not a pretty model. It's one that's not done in the ways that we think of as conventional foreign aid. It's a rough form of lifting one, lifting hundreds of millions out of poverty. And now we have China entering Africa and other places in a very expansive and dramatic fashion. And how do you begin to engage China around the kind of debate that you're attempting to push? Why don't we start with those two, and then, okay, then we can move and take a collection of comments and questions from the audience.
All right, Steve, thanks very much. How do we explain how we got to this moment? Well, partly, as I said, because we see it. We see it around us, and we can't pretend that we didn't know it was happening. I think because people have willed it so. Take the story of debt cancellation, debt relief. Go back 25 years. Was there any debt relief or debt cancellation for the poorest countries of the world? No, there wasn't. Gordon Brown and other finance ministers will tell you, when they gathered together in the past, people would say, yeah, I know it's a big problem. Such a shame we can't do anything about it. That was the conventional wisdom of the time. In the same way as when the dreamers of the 19th century said, I think all children should go to school. No doubt very wise, well-educated, knowledgeable, powerful men at the time tutted and said, don't be ridiculous. What happened in between? How did we move from no debt relief to HIPC, $70 billion worth of debt relief later, to the multilateral debt relief scheme agreed in Glen Eagles, potentially $50 billion, 20 countries already written off just about by the anniversary, because people weren't prepared to take, such a shame, can't do anything about it, for an answer. They weren't having it. And politics, frankly, in our country and elsewhere, got to work, combined with political leadership, because I think, you know, the two hand in hand have made a difference. Now, if it hadn't been for the enormous campaigns around the world, I don't think Glen Eagles would have produced the agreements that we got. Because when you know you've got lots of people behind you lobbying, campaigning, if you know that Bob Geldof is going to come and shout in your ear if you don't do the right things, it's quite an incentive for politicians to do in their hearts what they know is the right thing. And I think the third reason why is because this interdependence of the human race is now so, you know, plain as a pikestaff obvious that we're all in this together. And even if you think nothing can be done, and that's wrong, and even if you hope the rest of the world would go away and it won't, what happens elsewhere is eventually going to come and impact upon us. When I go to my constituency on Saturday and do four advice surgeries, which I shall do, from 9 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 40-50% of the people who will come to see me have had to flee their home in some other corner of our small and fragile planet. Cameroon, Zimbabwe, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Congo, and come and live in Leeds because they're seeking asylum. So there's one example of how events in one country affect us. Does it make sense for us to then prevent conflict in those countries so that people aren't forced to flee the land of their birth because of violence and intimidation? Well, of course it makes sense. And I just think there's a growing realization on the part of people that this is both morally the right thing to do and practically the thing that we have to do for the future of the planet. That's my take, but I'd be very interested in your view. China, well, you're right. when you look at the chart, goes back to 1981, when you had about 1.5 billion human beings on this planet of ours living on less than a dollar a day, and you forecast forward to 2015, when we think it'll be about 600 million. You know, where's the big decline been? China starts like this, and it just goes, and it virtually disappears because of the process that you yourself have described. South Korea is another example. At the end of the Second World War, South Korea was poorer than North Korea, and as poor as the poorest African countries of the time. Look at South Korea today. Indeed, when the colonial era ended, people were more worried about progress in Asia than they were in Africa. It's actually turned out to be the other way around. I think what it demonstrates is, you know, the power of economic development to help change things. And China has been, you know, very focused on what it's done. I think one of the reasons that we need to engage China, not only because of climate change, their need for energy, the importance of making sure that they generate energy in a way that doesn't add to the climate change problem, and they will very soon become one of the largest emitters in the world, but also because the policy they pursue in other countries will have an impact on development there. Mm-hmm. And so keeping a relationship, a conversation going with China about approaches to development is, I think, a really, really important thing to do. Wen Jiabao has just returned from, a seven-nation tour of Africa, seeking to secure energy supplies, raw materials, and long-term trade agreements. What do you think, since you asked the question?
Well, we're struggling with this very question about how do you begin to engage China? How do you find the points of commonality? I mean, there's clearly, as it enters Africa, the lead factor is extraction. It's access to scarce energy and hydrocarbons and hard rock minerals and the like. But there's also a very clear commitment around building health capacity, building infrastructure, revitalizing education, and investing in peacekeeping. Just to list, you know, three or four things where there's strong common purpose, in which there's an opening for a dialogue and engagement. On the environmental issues, I think we're a long distance away from figuring out how to deal constructively with the export of China's environmental problems into Africa. Mm-hmm. And some of what little we've seen in terms of analytic writing is pretty scary stuff. And it doesn't come with a clear strategy of how to engage on those fronts. Why don't we take some Mark Schneider, Hattie, and Joel. We have three questions right here. We can. There's a mic coming, Mark. Please identify yourselves.
Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. First, Mr.
Hi.
Minister, thank you very much for your support over the years. I think we all appreciate the broad and comprehensive kind of review given us on development challenges. Let me raise a couple of specifics. You talked about the importance of continuing to engage even when countries perhaps get off the track. And it's that this dichotomy between the a policy matrix that the donors and the international community feels is necessary in order for development to succeed and development aid to be successful, and then what happens when the policies, in fact, are not adopted or there are reversals. And as a result, and here let me give you a couple of examples.
Please.
Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I just came back from southern Afghanistan. When I was there before going into southern Afghanistan, the clear evidence was that dealing with the Taliban involved ensuring that there was reconstruction in Helmand and in those other areas.
Yep.
But that if they could go back across the border and have sanctuary in Pakistan, and in fact, you're the chief of staff of a colonel, British Army there, specifically said that the Taliban leadership remains in Quetta. So if you don't get the policy right in terms of Pakistan dealing with the sanctuaries of the Taliban, we're not going to be able to be successful, you're not going to be able to be successful to make reconstruction possible in southern Afghanistan. On drugs, you're the lead country, I have been the lead country on counter-narcotics in Afghanistan. If you can't get the policy right in terms of having President Karzai take action against those individuals in his government and police forces who are linked to drugs, it's going to be very difficult for those policies to work. How do you deal with that? And then one other thing, you mentioned responsibility to protect.
Yep.
And you also mentioned the Abuja Agreement and Darfur. Here's an example where, at the very least, you have to say the international community thus far has failed in terms of ending the threat to, in this case, perhaps 2 million civilians still at risk in camps in Darfur. What more needs to be done? Particularly today, I saw the SLA's. There is apparently they ceased. The SLA has stated that they're not going to implement the agreement that was signed by many in Abuja. Where do we go from here? What more? How are you going to be able to get the UN takeover of the peacekeeping forces, which everyone seems to feel is the essential next step if you, in fact, are going to protect civilian life in Darfur?
Why don't we take two other quick questions? Okay. Hattie Babbitt.
I very much appreciate your discussing the Industrial Revolution in the developed world and in the context of what's happening now in the developing world. And I wonder if you'd expand a little bit more on that. Most of the attention you gave to the subject was to talk about the responsibility of the international community, of the donors, to step up to the plate, see their responsibility, be generous, why it is that they now see that we're all one family on the planet, we're all interconnected. My question goes to the other side of the coin, and that is to ask you how you all have been successful with reluctant developing countries. I remember going to the Amazon basin and speaking with a man who was chopping down rosewood trees to make fixers for French perfumes, American perfume. I mean, I'm perfectly willing to dump on the French, but that wasn't the point. We said, "Oh, this is a terrible mistake. We chopped down our forests, and here were these. You know, we had these terrible consequences, and the Dust Bowl, and this is an important from a biodiversity standpoint. It's important from a sustainability standpoint. Blah 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 blah." And he basically said, "Look, you guys cut down your forests to develop. We're going to cut down our forests to develop. Mind your own business." You see the Chinese all over Africa, all over lots of places, not to point the finger at the Chinese just have the greatest appetite because of the scale. Mm-hmm. How have you all found, how has DFID found, to effectively deal with reluctance on the side of the developing countries to say we're part of this and here are our conditions for being part of this planetary family?
Joel Barkin, senior associate here at CSIS, and I can't help but say, born in Toledo, raised in Columbus, and a rooter for the hapless Indians. To my question.
We all have burdens to bear.
Indeed we do. Three related questions. I'd like you to return to your brief discussion of budget support. Your country was, I think it's fair to say, the most enthusiastic supporter of the concept, but in a number of selected places, there's some perhaps retreat from that position. So my question there is, under what criteria is the United Kingdom now perhaps calibrating budget support? And you cited Tanzania as one example, and perhaps you might compare it to others. The second, in respect to good governance, you mentioned accountability, building rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. I never heard the D word, and it seems there's a reluctance on the part of DFID to mention democracy as part of good governance because that stresses the demand side. And finally, what about the relationship between good governance and budget support? When does bad governance combined with budget support lead to a perpetuation of bad governance? For example, in Uganda, Ethiopia, two countries where you, in fact, have altered your program.
Right. Okay. Let's get going. There's a lot to cover there. Mark, first of all, I hope you don't mind if I'm familiar, and you can call me whatever you like in return. It's a deal. Afghanistan faces, well, as you know only too well, but you know, others haven't had the chance to go there, a really, really difficult task, because you've got a society which in part is of the kind that we would recognize if we went back a few hundred years in some of our own countries. Never was there a place where the old saying, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away, truer than of Afghanistan. Drugs is a major problem, but you know, you have the same conversation with farmers that Hattie had with the person who was chopping down the tree, and they'll say to you, well, this is the way I earn a better living. I've got to feed my family. If you can provide me another way of feeding my family in the same way, then I'll think about it. And we generate the problem, because after all, where's the stuff getting sold? It's getting sold on the streets of London and Leeds and Birmingham and parts of the States too. So in that sense, we help to create the problem as well. It's about doing things a stage at a time, frankly. There were some who sneered and sniffed, and Joel, you said we're reluctant to mention democracy. I hope that genuinely is not a charge that you could level at DFID, and you won't find me reluctant to mention it. There were some people who said, well, we'll never have elections in Afghanistan, don't be ridiculous, haven't got to that stage of development, and so on. Rubbish, to give it the technical term. Complete rubbish. The fact is, you see the people queuing up in Afghanistan, more controversially, Iraq, which we can get onto if anyone is keen, because I'm happy to debate that too. The fact is, the experience the world over is, if you give people the chance to have an influence over what happens to them in their lives, they're going to take it. But there is a lack of capacity in Afghanistan. Therefore, the way in which we give our aid, and it kind of links to your point, Joel, about budget support, we put a majority of our money through the government, the Afghan Reconstruction Trust Fund. One of President Karzai's complaints when he came to London for the Reconstruction Conference in January was, please, rest of the world, will you give more of your money to us? Because the more we have the resources and the capacity to deliver for people, the more people will look to the government and say, having a government of Afghanistan that can do something is a good idea. So, you know, it goes to the heart of this question, is whose capacity is it that we are trying to build? On the drugs front, yeah, it's a combination of enforcing the law, going after the big drug dealers. They've had some eradication efforts of their own, trying to provide alternative livelihoods. When I met the provincial council in Helmand, the list of things they wanted was kind of pretty obvious. We'd like water, we'd like the irrigation canals built by the states, by the Americans in the 1950s, to be cleared out because they're weed infested and they don't work. We want healthcare, we want education. But security is the key to all of this, because it's very hard to find partners to work with in Helmand. Why? Because BRAC, the NGO from has had some of its people killed. Chemonix, the company that the Americans working through, have had people attacked. Mercy Corps have been pulling back. And the Taliban's approach is very simple: intimidate anyone who's got anything to do with the nasty foreigners, or indeed anything to do with the government of Afghanistan. And yes, there is an issue about what's happening over the border, and it's one which President Karzai speaks volubly about, and which we and others raise with the government of Pakistan. But the last thing, as I think everyone would recognise, that Afghanistan needs is a return of the Taliban, because quite how any society can develop when a ruling, controlling group makes it illegal for half the next generation to have the most important start in life, which is girls going to school, frankly, is quite beyond me. On Darfur, Mark, well, the international community has not covered itself in glory, let's be blunt, and it's fine passing resolutions in the UN about responsibility to protect, but if people huddling in those camps tonight were even aware that we had done it, aware of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN Charter, then they might say, great words, and when are you going to apply it to me? And that's the challenge that we've got. Now, that is why Britain has been an enthusiastic supporter, along with others, of the AU mission. We were the first country in the world to give them financial support, because when it comes to turning those fine words into doing certain kinds of things, there are two problems. One is political will, two is capacity to act. And if you lack capacity to act because the burden's going to fall on a relatively small number of countries, then the knowledge of that sometimes gets in the way of the political will being exercised in the first place. So I'm really in favour of building capacity to do things. And so Africa taking greater responsibility for dealing with African problems is an unalloyed good thing. Now, AMIS has had some difficulties because it's a huge, complex operation. It's a very difficult conflict. And that's why some time ago Britain recognized with others that the transition to a UN mission was needed, because you get more boots on the ground. AMIS now says we haven't got enough troops. It deals with the financial problem. How are we going to make that happen? Well, I think by, and I talked to Bob Zillick about this today, frankly, by the United Nations and the African Union and the international community being absolutely resolute, this is going to happen, and saying to President Bashir, this is going to happen. After all, what's the issue of principle? There is a UN mission in Sudan already called UNMISS in the south, which followed the North-South Peace Agreement. On the deal itself, I don't know, the today's development is one I haven't heard about. Is it a perfect deal? No, it isn't. Does it represent a decent basis on which to get politics to move things forward? Yes, it does. Because the central demand of the rebels in Darfur, regional government. The deal provides, within 3 years, subject to a referendum, the D word, democracy, gives the people of Darfur that thing. And in the meantime, a lot of other stuff, which you'll be very familiar with. Is there a justification to carry on killing people? No, there isn't, in my view. I am desperately sorry that Abdul Wahid and Khalil Ibrahim didn't sign the agreement. I think it was a failure of leadership, and I will say that publicly. Hattie. Well, the conversation with the guy cutting down the tree is a, you know, is a very interesting one. And let's take illegal logging as an issue, because you know, if we turn up to hug the trees, then you do find someone patting you on the shoulder saying, excuse me, this is the way in which I earn my living. You know, can we have a conversation about what it is you're trying to do? And I know most about this from a visit to Indonesia I paid some years ago, because fundamentally the problem of illegal and unsustainable logging is a failure of governance, actually, because they don't have haven't had the capacity to regulate what happens to their natural resources. Now, if we're going to deal with illegal logging, it has to be a two-part deal. The producer countries have to put in place a mechanism that will enable them to certify timber when it is exported to say that it has been legally logged. And once they've got that in place, then we can do our part of the deal as importing countries and say, OK, now we know that arrangement is in place in Indonesia or somewhere else. When the timber arrives at, you know, Boston Harbor or Felixstowe or Harwich, the poor customs officer, who otherwise, how do they know whether it's illegal or legally sourced timber? But once you've got a mechanism in place, then the two can work hand in hand to try and deal with the problem. I think the second thing I would say is that in time, these countries are going to come face-to-face with the consequences of environmental degradation in the same way that we have come face-to-face with the consequences. And we have to encourage and support them in becoming more aware. Going back to your China point, Steve, very interesting, for the first time, public debate in China at the People's Congress in the autumn about the gap between rich and poor in China. I mean, there hasn't been a subject of debate before, but they're beginning to have to face up to the consequences of the uneven nature of their economic growth. Joel, well, I know there is a kind of caricature of DFID on budget support, which says we just sit and write checks and post them and say, thanks very much, you get on with it. That isn't the case, because 25% of our bilateral assistance goes in the form of a direct or sector budget support, so three-quarters of it doesn't. We asked the three questions. You asked, you know, how do we take the decisions? Well, it's based on those three questions. So in Zimbabwe, I said, we don't give money to the government at all. And I hope we've demonstrated by the decisions I took, one in relation to Ethiopia for Britain, and two in relation to Uganda, that we're serious about this. Now, when Ethiopia shot dead 50 people on the streets and locked up the leaders of the political parties, that D-word, democracy again, who just won a lot of seats in the election, my view was that I thought that was a breach of one of the principles on which our partnership is based, and all of the other budget support donors in Ethiopia shared that view, and with one step we said, direct budget support, no more. Now, in the end, that didn't change what Ethiopia has done, but we didn't run away. We didn't say, right, sorry, the people of Ethiopia, we're off because things aren't going fine. We've now, with the World Bank and others, come up with an alternative mechanism, greater accountability and scrutiny, to get money for basic services to people at the local level. But I think that was a very important moment, because it demonstrated that budget support is not, you know, there regardless. because I think you're giving a certain amount of trust to your partner when you give direct budget support. In the right circumstances, I remain convinced it's the right thing to do. But when that trust is breached, then it's important that we show that we will act differently. Uganda's a second example, where I reallocated £15 million of our budget support to humanitarian relief in the north. And Sierra Leone's another example, slightly unusual case, because in a fragile state where corruption is a big problem, you might say, well, why are you doing some budget support? In that case, because they lacked to such an extent any capacity to do anything. If government can't deliver some services, how's the country going to progress? But we have linked some of our budget support in future to them reducing the proportion of drugs that are stolen between being purchased by the Ministry of Health and actually getting to the clinics and hospitals on the ground. And I have no hang-ups about doing that at all, because for me that is the right type of conditionality in a debate that has been bedeviled on the economic policy side with what, in my view, has been the wrong type of conditionality. But I think it's very important that we demonstrate we're serious about this, because it helps to maintain this extraordinary public support for development on which we're going to rely if we're going to do more of this in future. And I think I'd mentioned democracy about five times in answering your question, all right? And I am elected, so I believe in it.
You know, the question, the division that you drew between the U.S. and Britain on budget support, it may not be quite as hard as you put it. I mean, the debate around flexibility and building credibility of your partner government is very alive in the way we're approaching Liberia right now. And it's very much a central question in the way the MCC is supposed to operate, Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is meant to place much higher trust and to make this a compact that's driven from the government itself.
It's very striking, man. I agree.
And so there's a change. There's a significant change underway here. Let's take a series of other questions. Jennifer Cook, George Ingram, David Throop, and then we'll come back. I promise you we'll come back for another round. Just hold for a moment.
Hi, Jennifer Cook with the CSIS Africa Program. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about Somalia, because while I think everybody, particularly since 9/11, agrees how interlinked security and poverty are and governance and so forth, the responses don't always necessarily reflect that. And the U.S. Strategy towards Somalia in recent months, as I'm sure you know, has been somewhat controversial here. And I wonder if it differs from how the United Kingdom sees it, whether it came up, for example, in your discussions with Zelic, and how you might see a way forward there with the United States or in concert with others.
Thank you, Secretary of State. I'm a Yorkshireman from Bradford, born and bred, so not very far from your constituency. I'd like to ask you two questions. First, Sierra Leone. The British government has devoted a great deal of attention to Sierra Leone, a great deal of money. And those of us who, as academics, work on Sierra Leone have become, I think, over the years, increasingly critical, fearful that what you have done was to rush in and to reconstruct the Sierra Leonean state, warts and all, and that you haven't really grappled with the fundamental failures of that state as it existed in the 1980s, early 1990s, and therefore, in the long term, take away the United Nations forces, that the fundamental social grievances, the fundamental corruption that brought about the RUF in 1990s are all too likely to come bubbling back to the surface, so that Sierra Leone may look like a moderate success now, but 3 or 4 years down the road, it's likely to lapse into catastrophic failure again. My second question is that in Britain over the last 3 months or so, there's been a great deal of discussion about Britain's role in corruption in the African continent, the Asian continent. So you had the report of the All Parties Parliamentary Group on Africa. You had Hugh Bailey's 10-minute rule attempt to introduce legislation. And then 2 days ago, you had Transparency International report on the enforcement of the OECD rules against corruption or corrupting African public servants. Now, that report identified Britain as one of the three most important failures, along with Japan and the Netherlands, in attempting seriously to introduce legislation and actually to implement that legislation which already exists to prosecute British citizens and British companies who are involved in corrupting African public servants. So clearly this has become an issue in British parliamentary life. It's not likely to go away. What do you think the government can do? I see that we have made no prosecutions under the legislation of 1998, which puts us, as I say, one of the three worst, that in the last 2 years there have only been four investigations of these issues in the United Kingdom, whereas there are some 90 in the United States. What excuse in terms of provision of funds and future legislation is likely to happen?
I'm George Ingram with the Education Policy and Data Center. And first of all, I want to thank you and congratulate you for the historic commitment of your government on education. You and the Dutch really are leading the world on this issue. I'll establish my bona fides with you that I've benefited over the years from a productive relationship with Desmond Birmingham. And my operation has been made stronger the last year by one of your senior education specialists, Felicity Townsend. My question is, what were the bureaucratic and political hurdles that you all had to overcome in order to be able to make this commitment to education? I'm hoping that will be instructive for us here in the United States. And my comment is, I hope you will use your experience and leadership to drag the U.S. along with you. We've had some commitment and leadership from the U.S. Congress and sort of modest interest by the executive branch.
Jennifer, Somalia. Gosh, where to begin? Well, so much happening recently. I was there about a month and a bit ago, and as well as going to Wajid, where I have to say the drought relief operation that we in the international community and others have been paying for has been remarkably successful given the difficulty of working in Somalia. I must say, my admiration for the UN and NGOs who I met, how they negotiate their way past checkpoints, sometimes have to pay bribes, go and get the food back that's been stolen by men with guns. They're just amazing people. And the fact that there isn't a large-scale disaster happening there is entirely due to their efforts. And they should be, you know, honoured for this and applauded. The other reason I went was to show some support for the transitional institutions and went to Badoa and met President Youssef, who'd actually been in London a month previously, Prime Minister Geddy and the Speaker of the Parliament. The Parliament, by the way, meets in a converted warehouse and they've punched holes in the wall to have windows and they've got advertising on the wall. And I said to the Prime Minister, why have you got adverts? He said, we have very little money. We have to generate income from whatever source we can. So when they get up and speak in the Parliament, they can stare at an ad for mobile phones. Their fundamental difficulty is that they have virtually no capacity. Got 43 ministers. If they've got one person in each of the, in inverted commas, departments, that's it. And there's nothing else connecting it to the rest of Somalia at all. They've been able to train some police officers in Puntland, some of whom are deployed in Baidoa in uniforms paid for by the European Community. But as one of the aid workers said to me, you know, some government's better than no government at all. Now, what's happened most recently, of course, has been the victory of the Islamic courts over the warlords in Mogadishu. My view is that, I know there's been a, you know, debate here, what is the character of the Islamic courts? I think there are some fundamentalists involved in it, but I think there's no doubting the popular support for the Islamic court movement because people hated the warlords. They'd had enough. And that's why they have swept them out and moved into Johar and and Bella Twain, and then halted. They have published letters saying we're not a home for al-Qaeda. The meeting that took place in Khartoum last week, which the Sudanese brokered between President Youssef and representatives of the ICU, was, I think, very important. They've agreed to meet in July. Quite how this is going to play out, I don't know. Ethiopia, of course, stirred, as we know, because they're worried about potential threat to them. I think we should support the transitional institutions, is my view, and we're doing it in a very practical way as Britain, capacity building and actually helping to pay the stipends of the MPs who are meeting in Baidoa. On the very practical basis, it's better they stay there and talk than go back to what was happening in the 15 previous attempts to try and bring peace to Somalia. In our country, just devastated by this. 80% of kids have never seen the inside of a classroom. I mean, you know, if you... And actually, no one's absolutely sure those statistics are right because there's nobody there to count. But this is a, you know, a deeply traumatized and troubled place. There is going to be a debate, of course, about the arms embargo because the transitional institutions say, hey, if you want us to have capacity to impose some security on the country, should we have the means? There's a debate within IGAD about a peace support operation, nervousness about frontline states being involved. I think that's a difficult one because given the problems in getting more troops for AMIS, where exactly would capacity for a peace support operation for Somalia come from? I think we must hope and support a process of dialogue as a way of moving the country forward because it desperately needs it after all it's suffered. But you followed it, obviously, with great interest, and I'd be interested in your view. David, well, Sierra Leone, I don't think the term rushing in, I don't think that's a kind of fair reflection of what we did. Okay, when the RUF and the West Side Boys were hard at it, chopping people's limbs off with their machetes, as we know, was their way of going about and doing things, and the Brits went back in, this being a former colony. I know in Britain some people raised their eyebrows and said, what's going on here? All I can say is we did that. Eventually that brought to an end. UNAMSIL came in. UNAMSIL is now gone, of course. They did a really good job, and there is relative peace and security. Now, IMAT remains, training the police, which is, I think, in a slightly more advanced state, and the armed forces, which is in a less advanced state, so they have the capacity to secure the borders and maintain internal security. And you ask people in Sierra Leone, public opinion, and so on, I think people are genuinely and profoundly appreciative of what we in the United Nations have done. But I don't disagree with you when you say that there are fundamental problems of governance and corruption in Sierra Leone. That is true. And therefore, it is about the political process in that country trying to address those. I think it's better the international community has been in there, has a stake in seeing this process succeed, than if we weren't. I don't know what the alternative approach is that you would suggest, and again, I'd be genuinely interested in your views on that, and I hope to be going back to Sierra Leone in the not-too-distant future and could pursue the points that you've raised. Britain has played a part, of course, in saying that if Charles Taylor is convicted, we'll stick him in jail. Because there was a kind of pass the parcel mm-hmm. went on when, you know, he needs to be out of there in The Hague for reasons that I completely agree with. That's Britain playing a part. On corruption, well, yes, the other side of the coin, the All Party Group on Africa's report, excellent. We published our response. I don't know if you had a chance to, you have read it. Okay, well, you're completely up to speed then. Last Friday, as you know, the Prime Minister's asked me to take on responsibility ministerially for fighting corruption. We've ratified the UN Convention. It's a genuine query. Has the states ratified the UN Convention against corruption? Anybody know? I think may have signed, but I'm not sure whether ratifications take place. Pardon? Signed but not ratified. Okay. In a very British way, we didn't ratify until we had put all the legislation in place to allow us honourably to ratify. We strengthened our money laundering legislation. In the reply last week, we announced the setting up of a new unit staffed by Met Police, City of London Police, which DFID is helping to fund. Some people raised their eyebrows and said, what's the Development Department funding a unit that will investigate corruption, money laundering? For reasons implicit in your question, I think it's a very good thing to do. Bluntly, on prosecutions, genuinely, if you tell me there are people who need to be investigated and you say we're not investigating, tell us and I'll get on the case. I mean, there are two conclusions you can draw. Either there's a lot of corruption going on and we're not doing it. Give us the evidence and we'll get to work. That's why I'm funding the unit, to add to the capacity that was already there. But I need no persuading at all of the importance of us playing our part in demonstrating global good governance, because it's the other side of the coin, pardon the pun, of the focus on good governance in countries. You need good global governance, whether it's climate change, dealing with illegal logging, preventing people from coming to Britain and elsewhere with bags of money that they've nicked from other countries. A governor from Nigeria did that recently, rather embarrassingly managed to escape dressed as a woman. But I'm glad to be able to report to you that he's been arrested in Nigeria and is currently facing trial. I tell you what the Nigerians could do to help. They could finally change the law that prevents sitting state governors from being prosecuted for corruption. Because if I acted corruptly, I have no immunity. I'd get prosecuted. And Nigeria, it's in their own hands to actually deal with that. George. Well, hurdles. I'm a really lucky man. Where are you, George? Yeah. Because I've got a Prime Minister and a Chancellor who are absolutely passionate about this, you know? And it's great. Now, we're lucky because we're able to make three-year commitments, because I get my money in three-year batches. Because when Labour came in 97, we moved to a three-year rolling public expenditure framework. And that's why we're able to make those shortish term commitments. That's better than a lot of other countries. But in this special case, because in the end, if that nice man in charge of the Treasury says, OK, you can make a 10-year commitment, and we're on an escalator to the 0.7% by 2013, first government in British history to commit to a date, that's the end of the advert. In the end, we reached agreement because we just felt it was so important to show that the Gleneagles deal means something in the long term. And for reasons that you will know only too well, getting the kids into school is a practical problem. And this is my graph, and it's not entirely accurate, but, aid in the last 20 years has kind of gone like this, sort of. Now, if I said to you, I'm going to give you a job, George, and you'd say, great, how much am I going to get paid? And I'd say, well, your salary is going to go like this. You'd say, I beg your pardon? I'd say, well, it's going to go like this. And you'd say, I'd say, what's the problem, George? And you'd say, well, I like the bit at the top, but I'm not so keen at the bit at the bottom. And I'd say, well, what's the problem, George? And you'd say, well, I've got commitments. I've got bills to pay. I've got a mortgage to pay off. I've got kids to feed. And education ministers are exactly the same. And if they're going to train the teachers, buy the books, build the classrooms, they need long-term commitments. And that's why we did it. And I hope it will act as an encouragement to others in the international system to say, can you make a long-term commitment? Because if we can put your commitment and your commitment alongside our commitment and the commitment of the 22 countries that are preparing 10-year plans, then we're in a much better place to train the teachers and buy the books and build the classrooms and provide the water and the sanitation, which will mean that we will get to the point where all those kids get to school. That's why we did it.
Thank you. On just one quick set of comments on Somalia. Until this episode, this recent victory by the ICU and their militias in Mogadishu, it was impossible to get a serious discussion going in Washington around, an open discussion around Somalia and U.S. policy. That suddenly changed. Suddenly there is a debate, there's a hearing tomorrow, there's a lot of press interest and the like. And the administration's been very embarrassed by these outcomes, but they've been reasonably open in their approach, it seems to me, in the stance that was taken in these various moments in the last 2 weeks. But it's very fragile right now. I mean, it's very fragile because if the leadership of the ICU moves in the direction of dominance by OIS and others, it's going to close the door here in Washington for an ability to engage. There's sort of there's a margin. There's certain red lines, it seems to me, that the administration will not be able to cross, given the history of these fellows and their known documented history, people like OIS. The other problem is that
And there's no answer now as to how there's going to be any foreign boots put on the ground to stabilize that situation. I mean, all the options look like non-options right now. I mean, IGAD, UN, AU, NATO, Coalition of the Willing, UN, whatever. It just doesn't seem feasible at all. So you're left in the position of, you know, either being reliant upon the Ethiopians or being reliant upon just dealing with those realities on the ground. Also, we just don't know where, if the Islamic courts are seeing themselves as a Hamas-like entity, a social movement that's become militarized, that is able to put a stick in the eye of the West. Are they drawing support from alternative channels? And this is a question I wanted to put to you. I mean, are they going to draw their legitimacy and some of their support from those who would like to see this look like Taliban Jr., you know, or like Hamas? And is that one option, one scenario that we're staring at as an alternative to the idea that they will moderate, they will talk to the TFG, they will deliver these letters to the West? And I think we need to countenance that possibility. There's some other questioners. There's a woman in the rear there, and then this gentleman right here. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Kari Heerman from the German Marshall Fund. You mentioned as Kari. Yep. You mentioned as one of your challenges getting a good result from the Doha round of world trade talks that can lead to trade being used as a platform for economic development in the developing countries. And as it looks now, the result that may come out of those talks looks like it's on the relatively low ambition side in terms of what it might really offer to developing countries. And there are a number of tweaks that could make that different. One that you mentioned is offering full duty-free, quota-free access to the least developed countries into the richest markets, which, as you know, the European Union already does and U.S. doesn't. But there's a number more multilateral steps that could be taken, one of which is lowering the number of agricultural products that are sheltered from the really steep tariff cuts. And if not within the Doha round, but alongside it, the discussion on aid for trade, do you see strong support for that, something that could actually provide support for countries that might want to create the institutions necessary to certify their lumber, practically be able to do that? So what do you see? Are there any prospects for either of those?
Thank you, sir. There's a microphone right here. Laura and Kate, you should jump in and ask questions, too.
Thank you. My name is Irving Rosenthal. I'm a professor at American University. Mr. Ben, you opened your comment by talking about there are some people who praise and some people who excoriate the United States. I think most of your presentation was praise, and I'm a leading question on the excoriation side. There has been an awful lot of organizational change going on in the U.S. foreign aid program over the last 9 months. The whole intellectual community in Washington has been discussing it. Steve, you were at a meeting on Friday at Brookings Institution on the whole issue of the organization, and the paper that you were publishing talks about a number of different approaches. Well, would you have some comment on some of the major differences? Let me rephrase the issue. In Great Britain, you have a separate independent agency for development, and you have a separate Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In the United States, we're going back and forth on this particular issue, moving away from a strong independent aid agency to one that's related to the foreign aid organization. While you were here, you said you've spoken to MCC, Tobias at Aid, people at State Department. Do you have any feeling that we're a little bit confused on how we're running our aid program? Thank you.
My name is Tamotsu Nakano. I'm a former visiting fellow of Brookings. I come from Kyoto, Japan. Thank you very much for an excellent presentation. I have two questions. First one, Liberia and Iraq. Before regional conflict started in Liberia in 1987, I worked as a United Nations expert to promote small and medium-scale enterprises. I learned, you know, the process before the regional conflict started. And I think the most important thing is to learn what grassroots people are thinking. I have a request to you, and organize a big essay contest in Africa and ask three questions. The primary school children, the junior high school children, and high school, university, and the entrepreneurs. What is the best way to improve your capacity? Second, what you can do for your government? Third one is how to start small and medium scale enterprises in terms of creating employment. And second one is Iraq. 25 years ago, I worked in Baghdad to lay the water pipes. Iraq is a rich country. Iraq has oil revenues, 2.5 million barrel a day. It was $250 million. If we create the microfinancing project for Iraq people, Iraqi population is only 22 million. The working labor force is only 6 million. If we try to provide $250 million to each Iraq people, particularly 6 million working force, Iraq people can get $10,000 per year. I think instead of creating a big infrastructure project, it's better to provide microfinance to Iraq people. I want to get your opinion on that. Thank you.
Carly, right. On Doha and trade. Well, we're stuck at the moment and have been since December. We've got three big blocks. We've got the States, we've got Europe, we've got the big developing countries, China, India, Brazil, and each one is saying to the other, we think we've made a decent offer. If you want us to move further, you've got to move first. And so we have a logjam. Question is, how can the logjam be broken? And you make a very good point about the duty and quota-free access. You know, that's why I said 97% isn't really enough. If Europe can do it, hey, why can't everybody else? Reducing the proportion of sensitive products, I agree with you. Aid for trade, we made a bit of progress in Hong Kong on that, the commitment both from the UK and from Europe, because it's one thing to have rules which enable you to trade. It's another thing to have something to sell and the capacity to actually get it out the country. And that's really important, particularly for Africa, both because the high cost of transport in Africa is a real impediment to economic activity. The fact that it costs more to shift a container from one bit of Africa to another than it does to bring the container to Africa from Japan in the first place explains that. It's the same reason why fertilizer is incredibly expensive for farmers in Ethiopia, because of the cost of getting it there. Therefore, if it's expensive, you can't spend as much money on trying to improve your land. And I think the other thing is there are changes in regulation and approach to business which countries can make. That's what the Investment Climate Facility for Africa, which was launched in South Africa on the 1st of June, an African idea originally picked up by the Commission for Africa, advocated by Britain. We're funding it. The World Bank's funding it. The Irish are funding it. We hope the Dutch and the Norwegians will put some cash in. One or two other companies have. That's looking at doing something about the things that make it less likely that people will come and invest their money. Now, we know in Africa, mobile telephony is the best example. No problem in getting investment for mobile telephony. It's the fastest growing market in the world. But when it comes to reforming your customs procedures, you can do that yourself. From another part of the world, Bangladesh, it takes you 6 to 7 days to clear your goods through customs on average, 38 signatures. Singapore, 6 to 7 hours, 2 signatures. That's nothing to do with the WTO. It's not the colonial legacy. It's up to you to decide how to regulate the way in which your customs systems work. So I think there's a lot that countries can do themselves, greater economic integration in Africa. But at the moment, we're absolutely stuck. Now, whether we're going to get a breakthrough or not, I don't know. But if we fail to take the opportunity now, we will be passing up for the moment probably the single most important step we could take to help countries lift themselves out of poverty. Irving. Well, I'd say my speech was one of encouragement. I'm a great believer in encouraging everybody, and far be it from me to advise the American administration on how they should organise their foreign aid, because I've learnt that much in my job. It's not for me to do that. But what I would reflect back to you is some of the impressions I'll take away from this visit. I think the debate that has taken place in the States about how this should be done is an extremely interesting one, and I know there are some people, I met the NGOs yesterday, who said, where exactly does reducing poverty figure in all of this? But you read Randy Tobias's speeches, and I spoke to him today, and he says very resolutely, oh, yes, it does. This has not been lost in this reorganization. I come away with a very strong sense of commitment, particularly from the MCA to developing country ownership. I welcome what Randy Tobias has had to say about, which I mentioned in my speech, not proliferating parallel systems, because I think that comes out of the analysis which we share about the importance of strong government. I think the final thing I would say is that lots of people have said, well, it's a bit too early to be sure about how this is going to work out in practice. In the case of the work that Randy Tobias is doing, preparing all of these country plans, which are meant to integrate, as was described to me today, everything that the different bits of the administration, including the MCA, are doing in countries, and I think everyone will get a better idea when those plans emerge. I think it's a generally interesting time, and I am keen to find areas in which we can work together, but as I demonstrated, I hope, in my speech today, where we have a difference of view, I won't be shy about expressing what we think is the right approach to take, in exactly the same way as the States and other countries will do the same. You mentioned Liberia, microfinance. It'd be a very interesting essay contest that you suggested. We did a little survey on the back of the Commission for Africa. We added a question to an omnibus survey that's done in 6 or 7 African countries every so often. And the question was, who do you hold most responsible for the state of your country? And the reply came back in every case, our government. I thought it was really, genuinely, I thought it was encouraging. Because, it shows that in the end, wherever you're in government, you get the blame for the state of the country. But I thought that was a good thing, because they didn't say the donors, the West, the WTO, our government. And that's, a really important building block if governance itself is going to improve. First things first, in places like Liberia, security, basic improvement in services, that's what the new president is very committed to do, and I had the chance of meeting her when she came to London a month and a half ago. In Iraq, I agree with you, it is a rich country. Its natural resources are very considerable. The same issue is one of security, because if they could get the security and the politics right, bluntly, then there's absolutely no reason why Iraq shouldn't prosper and prosper pretty quickly. Now, they have some difficult choices they face, both on the politics and security, both on the low cost of fuel, because it's at a very, very low price. That's why people smuggle it, because if you sell it across the border, you make a complete killing. The food basket, which is subsidized. And I think the challenge for the government there is to begin to make the transition from spending a lot of their income on these things, which are indiscriminate. Yes, of course, poor people need protection, but does everybody need gas at, what is it now, 3 cents a litre, even after the increase which the transitional government put in place recently? They do need some big infrastructure, above all electricity. Because despite the effort over the last 3 years, it's a clapped-out system, it's falling apart, they haven't got the right fuels, they lack the skills to maintain it, people keep blowing up some of the pylons. So now there is a permanent government in place. I hope they will look at the long-term investment that is required in improving electricity generation, because it's the biggest single complaint of people. But is the politics working in the end? I genuinely think there's a chance with the new government that that will come good. But ultimately, that's a decision that only the Iraqi people themselves can take. It's their country, it's their future.
Did you have any comments on Somalia?
Sorry, on Somalia. I did discuss this with Bob Zelik today. I think what I said about the Islamic courts was, it's really too early to be absolutely sure about the character of this organization, this entity, this movement, however you characterize it. But if they are talking with the transitional government and that process appears to have started, then that is a process of dialogue that we should encourage, and then make judgments on the basis of what emerges, because it strikes me that that's a lot better than what might be the alternative. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think it's too early to tell.
Thank you. Let's take one more round of questions here. There's two folks right here. And then we'll come over to... Yes,
Susan
please.
Susan Bornstein from TechnoServe, an economic development agency. You talked
Sorry,
about...
Sorry, could you just speak up a little louder? What was your name?
Susan Bornstein from TechnoServe, an economic development agency. You talked about capacity building across all the priority objectives that you mentioned. When you mentioned economic growth, you didn't speak, or maybe you could speak a bit more expansively on capacity building, because you talked mostly about market access and tariff reform. And so I'm curious what you see as the most effective kinds of capacity-building initiatives that DFID could support to promote private sector development in Africa, especially since the aid for trade discussions often focus at kind of the 40,000-foot level and not at the practical solutions entrepreneurs need to trade. So I'm wondering about your perspectives on that debate.
Aaron Goldblatt. I'm with GSI here at CSIS. I wanted to know about what your prospects for solving the aid problem in corrupt countries, particularly like where Kenya, where corruption is so rife that, you have the anti-corruption minister being indicted for corruption. You brought up how, constructing institutions, rule of law, things like that. But what about in countries where the government is repressive, tyrannical, and very corrupt? How do you, alleviate the problem of aid not going to where it should be going to?
Thank you. One question over here.
Hello, it's Felicity. I've already been introduced. Hi. This is a political question. Yesterday I was lucky enough to be in the audience of a meeting preparing to go up to the capital to lobby for an increase in the international affairs budget. And one of the speakers was Madeleine Albright. And she said that American people thought that a lot of international aid went on corrupt regimes, and that therefore the only way you could sell a larger budget for international affairs was by putting it under the label of national security. To me, as an outsider, that seems like a council of despair, because I think, even though I've been outside Britain, I've seen evidence that there's been a successful public political campaign that DFID has played a part in. So rather than accept that, or perhaps even encourage the idea that aid is not worth it, can you say something about what worked in Britain to help turn the tide? Because I know that some polls showed that British people also were worried about corruption and about the effectiveness of aid. Thanks.
Leah Belshaw, I'm an intern with the Americas program here at CSIS, so forgive me if I turn this discussion towards the Western Hemisphere. But I was wondering if you could comment on the Bolivarian Revolution led by Hugo Chavez, currently with Cuba and Bolivia also on board, and their successes with the basic needs of development with the Yo Si Puedo literacy campaign and Operation Miracle. And we've been talking about political will and good governance, and it seems that these countries are independent in their political will and taking charge of development in their own countries, but then they have questionable governance. Obviously, with Cuba, the issues are there. And then with Chavez and Morales, although they're democratically elected, turning into more authoritarian regimes with changes to their constitution and whatnot. So just your thoughts on that.
To disappoint, first of all, in answering your last question, we have a relatively limited program in Latin America. Obviously, I follow with interest what's happening there, but I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on the subject. But it's very interesting to see how what some of those countries, Chavez and others, are doing. how it plays here in the United States. I mean, slightly less so, I'd have to say, in the UK, although there has been some coverage, and he did come on a visit to London a little while ago, and I think actually met the mayor of London, but he didn't see anybody else in the administration. People ask about Cuba. We don't have a development program there either. It gives me a chance to mention the D word again, but I hope in time things will change. Susan, you asked about the private sector development. Well, I mentioned the Investment Climate Facility, the Infrastructure Consortium for Africa, because in the wake of the Commission, we brought together, as a UK initiative, all the major investors, World Bank, EC, African Development Bank, who are interested in putting cash into infrastructure investment. The MCI, I'm aware, is also doing work on that front, just to try and get our act together a bit better. One of the problems with the African Development Bank has been its capacity to shift the money effectively. Donald Kabarouk has arrived, and I think he's going to change those things. I think access to finance is undoubtedly an issue. That may be because interest rates are phenomenally high and it's too expensive to borrow. It could be because people have no property rights and therefore can't offer up any collateral to be able to raise funds to invest in their business. Reforming customs. I mean, working in a number of areas. CDC, which is the old Commonwealth Development Corporation, has actually proved to be very successful in finding ways of persuading venture capitalists to invest their money in developing countries. Now, some people get a bit kind of confused about this. There's an article in the Sunday Times recently which said, shocking, CDC was putting up money for a luxury shopping centre in Nigeria. Now, fair point, except who do you think built the shopping centre? The answer is it provided employment for people in Nigeria. Who's going to work in the shopping centre? It's going to provide jobs for people in Nigeria, and people in Nigeria with money will be able to go and spend it. So there is in the UK, and I have no idea whether it's the case in the States, but there are parts of the development movement that are a bit confused about private investment. Because I do meetings and people say, oh, private sector, oh, that's a bit dodgy. Oh, multinational companies, oh, we don't want multinational companies coming investing in developing countries. Well, that's not what developing countries themselves say. And if Africa, part of Africa's tragedy, sub-Saharan Africa's tragedy, has been that about 40% of the wealth it generates every year seeks a home outside of the continent. Question, if Africa can't hang on to just about half the wealth it itself generates, how's it going to persuade anybody else to come and invest their money? We've got to tell it straight about the importance of economic development, because, as I said, that's where the money's going to come from to pay for these things. That's where our money comes from, to pay for the things that we take for granted. So let's get serious about this. Aaron, you asked about Kenya. Well, very, very interesting, Kenya, because grand corruption has been endemic, as we know. Kibaki was elected in 2002 on a platform, the new Rainbow Coalition, we're going to deal with corruption. They didn't. And John Gitongo comes along, or leaves Kenya, goes to live in Oxford, which he has. I met him a couple of months ago, produces his dossier. And then something astonishing happens. Three senior ministers resign. Never, ever happened before in the history of Kenya. And my sense is that something has begun. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. It's really hard for those who want to stuff it back in. How it's going to play out, I don't know. The investigation's taking place into those three ministers. Will there be prosecutions? Because you can have, you know, there is no country in the world where bribery and is not illegal. You can have anti-corruption commissions. Do you enforce the law? That's the question. It's political will. Will you go after people? But I think something is afoot there, which it's going to be very hard to undo. And after all, who's pushing it in Kenya? The press and the public. Because they've said, oi, you promised, and it isn't happening. And at some point, I think, within the Kenyan political system, somebody's going to come forward and say, hey, you really want a drive against corruption, I'm the person to vote for. And then I think politics will help to push this on. And how do we respond? Well, in the case of Kenya, going back to the direct budget support question, Britain doesn't give direct budget support to Kenya because we took the decision some years ago, corruption's too big a problem, we won't do it. Now, we do give sector support in education. In Kenya, one change they have made is the money for non-salary expenditure in schools now goes direct from the Ministry of Education to the school bank account, bypassing a stage in the middle where people might be tempted to filch stuff. And a lot of schools now publish how much they've had and what they've spent it on. Now, when you do that, then parents can say, well, why haven't you spent the entitlement this year? Can we have some more money on books? When are you going to provide some more clean water? And so that mechanism, combined with transparency, I think helps to answer your question. But I haven't pulled the plug on that because there's a problem of grand corruption, because all you do is end up penalising poor people in communities and not addressing the major problem, while at the same time being resolute in saying, come on, what are you going to do about this? Felicity. Well, I think first we have to say aid works. You know, we've got to be resolute. That's why I gave you a number of examples in my remarks today, because it does work. But you're right. You survey the British public, and a lot of them think it all goes in corruption. Now, that isn't the case. But we have to demonstrate that that isn't the case, and we have to explain how we safeguard the money. We have to show that we're prepared to change the way in which we give our aid when circumstances vary. We've got to make a better assessment of the state of governance in countries. I think, secondly, in Britain, because there's such a powerful movement for development, the churches, the campaigning NGOs, question for the United States. Churches, faith movements are very, very active in other aspects of politics in America. You know, abortion, what people get up to in their bedrooms and things like that. Question, why isn't there the same interest in development? And yet one of the conundrums we have to kind of grapple with is that Americans as individuals are astonishingly generous. It's one of the things that people in Britain don't quite understand when they look at the level of aid. Now, maybe this is a kind of cultural political thing, if I may be bold enough to comment, that there isn't quite the same expectation that government will do it all on behalf of all of us collectively, but a greater realization of the individual responsibility to contribute. And all the surveys show, you know, the Americans are very generous. And actually, when you talk to people here, there have been surveys in the States, people thinking actually that a much bigger proportion of their budget goes on development assistance than is the case. So there's a lot of things to kind of unpick there. But it's a big and important part of politics. And if I make a party point in the British context, the fact that the major opposition party, the Conservatives, now want to be in exactly the same place as the Labour government is on development is a really good thing, because it shows that we have won the argument domestically in Britain on why this matters. And that's a good thing, because, you know, whatever happens in the future in Britain, it'd be very, very hard for any government in years to come coming along and saying, well, actually, we're going to cut the aid budget. And that shows if you've, you know, the argument is good, the case is made, there's public support, political pressure, political leadership, you can change things. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. The debate here in the United States around foreign assistance is changing, and it's changed pretty dramatically since 9/11. And the moral and you know, the case for aid is made together with the security argument today. You go back to the National Security Strategy Statement that was issued in 2002 after 9/11. Is a dramatic turnaround in terms of the rationale for development aid. The fact that you've had all of these signature White House initiatives that have drawn significant bipartisan support is quite important, quite important. And that the churches are a big factor here in the United States. And you do have some translation of some of the Jubilee campaign and other things into data and some of the strategies, the One Campaign data, which have drawn significant support, have taken many of the models from the campaigns in Britain and Europe and transposed those into an American setting, and they're beginning to show some significant results.
I do recognize that. It's just the involvement of the churches in the development campaigns in Britain is so strong, so evident, so forceful. Yes. All the meetings I do up and down the country, the people who come along are a lot of them motivated by their faith in one form or another.
Yeah, thank you. On behalf of everyone here, and I want to thank Hannah Robinson, Elizabeth Sullivan, for helping put this together. On behalf of everyone here, I just want to thank you. This has been an extraordinary conversation, and we hope you'll come back again soon and join us again. Thank you. Thanks very much.